Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
Yeah, we did. We started to burn many things we found. That's the wonderful Dora Williams singing the Solartopia song. We're going to be joined in a minute by Randy Hayes, my good buddy from so many years of wonderful activism. He's a great, great guy. I'm really honored to have him on the show. We have a lot going on in the world today. I am in central Ohio where it's pouring down rain, but the big news across the country is the drought in California. And I had just read a disturbing piece. You know, there's just no end to the corporations and their greed. Nestle, for God's sakes, is exporting water from California in the middle of this drought. They've been asked by their local communities to stop doing it. And they just refuse to do so. California is going to have to cut back on its water usage, starting first and foremost with some of these ridiculous golf courses and rich people's fancy ornamental gardens and things like that. But I want to put forth a great idea that's been put forward by a longtime anti-nuclear activist named Tom Campbell. Tom has advocated covering the aqueducts with photovoltaic cells. One of the biggest users of electricity in California is pumping water. And what we need to do is pump water using photovoltaic cells, which will cover the aqueducts, which will actually stop a lot of the evaporation as well. I think it's really something worth looking into. We've got to get both the energy crisis and the water crisis under control, and it's time to do it in many ways, shapes, and forms. So we are on with another California boy, although he has a wild and varied background, Randy Hayes, my longtime co-conspirator. Randy, how you doing, buddy?
Hey, it's good. It's good to be with you, Harvey.
Good. Well, it's good to be with you. It was fun to see you in Washington, D.C. A couple of days ago. You were there with the great Brent Blackwelder in the legendary Kramer Books Cafe, and you are an indomitable activist. Tell us, Randy, how long you've been doing this. And you started the Rainforest Action Network way back in the previous century. Tell us a bit about that and then what you're doing now, if you would.
Yeah, I think it was 1885, maybe, I started Rainforest Action. Maybe it was 1985. But I ran that for about, 15 years. And then I went into 7 years of green city government in San Francisco and Oakland and worked for the now governor, Jerry Brown, as the director of sustainability in Oakland. And then I moved to Washington, D.C. in 2009 to start a think tank called Foundation Earth, which would look at some of the kind of deeper systemic level changes in the rules of the global economy. How do we ecologize capitalism until we can better come up with invent a new economic ism?
Ism. Didn't Abby Hoffman say isms or wasms?
He did, but we need an economic ism because the socialism, communism, capitalism isms are so tired. And they're so devoid of concern for the rules and ways of Mother Nature.
Well, tell us first a little bit about Rainforest Action Network, which you started. What was Rainforest Action Network about? It's still going, right?
Yeah, it is, absolutely. And I spent 10 years after college living out with the Hopi Indians near the Grand Canyon. And I was sort of secretary and chauffeur to the elders, these 90, 95, 100, 105-year-old, wise old archetypal men and women who know something about deep long-term sustainability and being farmers in a desert over thousands of years. So that was my training ground, oddly, in the desert for Rainforest Action Network. When myself and Herb Gunther from Public Media Center in San Francisco, Mike Rozelle, and a few other people got together and started Rainforest Action Network, it was a blend of Friends of the Earth and Greenpeace in the sense that we wanted to have bold, gutsy policy stands like Friends of the Earth, and we wanted to use the civil disobedience, the nonviolent civil disobedience tactics of Greenpeace. So we started the Burger King boycott, and we started pounding them with demonstrations day after day and month after month. It took about 18 months to get them on one bended knee, and they finally canceled a $35 million beef contract with Costa Rica. It was the major cause of destruction of rainforest there.
And so you won.
Yeah, we won that fight, and it sent shockwaves through the cattle industry, not just in Costa Rica, but throughout Central and South America. It also sent some shockwaves through the other fast food franchises. We never had any evidence on McDonald's using rainforest beef, but this shook them up enough to make sure that they didn't go that direction. And yeah, it was also a very good device to popularize the need to care about tropical rainforest, because in the mid-1980s, it was not a big-ticket issue on the global laundry list of environmental concerns. And now, of course, it is.
And, yeah, well, good work, Randy. Thank you for that.
Well, hopefully I'm not done. You know, if we can just ecologize capitalism until we come up with a better ism, you know, then I think I might take a break.
Well, let's hear what you're thinking along those lines. Obviously, you've done some thinking about this. We know you write great memos and take on the big issues. So ecologizing capitalism, tell us what you're thinking about.
Sure. Well, the precursor to this approach was after the Burger King victory, then we took on Mitsubishi, which is the largest corporation in Japan for their logging of the island of Borneo and eradicating the last hunting and gathering tribe over there. We won that.
All right, so how did you win? Did they stop cutting down the forest in Borneo? Is that what happened?
Well, in the case of Mitsubishi, they also have a lot of pulp and paper mills around the world, and the winning in that case was that they switched their supply to Forest Stewardship Council certified timber or chips for their paper mills. And they did that for all of their paper mills, not just in tropical rainforests, but in the temperate rainforests of Australia and Tasmania and also up in Canada. So that was the victory there. Home Depot.
And you forced this on Mitsubishi worldwide?
Yes, we did.
And who is the Forest Sustainability Council?
The Forest Stewardship Council.
Stewardship. Oh, so who are they and what do they do?
It's a certification, like certifying organic food, only they certify lower impact logging. It's not the deep solution that I would prefer. I think we should stop all logging in all native forests. The world has just taken too much already. You know, if you do think of the forest as the lungs of the planet, and we've cut down over half of the world's forest, then that means we're operating on one lung, right? That's not a good strategy for survival and sustainability, and certainly not for prosperity. So after those victories, then we took on Home Depot, which was the largest retailer of wood on planet Earth. People know the Home Depot giant box stores, and they had all kinds of different products that came from old growth forests all over the world. It might be, you know, the handle in a hammer or a rake. It might have been a mahogany door. It could have been a simple wooden dowel for hanging your bath towel on it from Southeast Asia. But we finally got them after like a national, international day of demonstrations. We had something like 113 demonstrations at Home Depot stores across the country and southern Canada, and all on the same day. So if you had, you know, 100 store managers calling up Atlanta, Georgia to Central Command saying, what the hell's going on? I got these hippies hanging off my building, hanging banners. I've got people dressed up like toucans and rainforest animals handing out leaflets in front of my store. So we finally got Home Depot on one bended knee, and then the victory there was getting Home Depot to send a letter to the biggest logging companies in the world saying, we will no longer buy your products unless they become Forest Stewardship Council certified. So those were the kind of victories we won. This is all leading towards ecologizing capitalism. The connection tissue is that those settlements were voluntary codes of conduct. And, you know, if you don't have the person power to watchdog them afterwards, and that's hard, then you've got the fox guarding the hen house. You don't have a mandatory system of change. And ultimately, there's a change in administration or the CEO or the chair of the board or the senior staff. They didn't feel the pain of the boycotts and the demonstrations. And so that's all to say that those victories, heroic as they were, are insufficient at stopping the destruction of the world's forests. We need something bigger and bolder.
What would it be?
And that led us to, you know, if you can change the rules of the economy so that it's no longer profitable to do damage to nature, then you begin to have that deeper solution. I mean, one has to be honest and say that sounds like a snowball's chance in hell of accomplishing it. But frankly, if we don't accomplish it, then we're all just going to, you know, perish on this beautiful blue-green planet as we turn it into a toxic furnace.
So what's your strategy for saving the forests worldwide?
Well, we're putting forth a vision right now that we're just in construction around, and we're going to launch it on Earth Day, April 22nd, coming up quite soon. And that's just getting a lot of the Save the Forest groups around the world, hundreds and hundreds of them, in fact, and some UN bureaucracies like the UN Forum on Forest and the people working on the Convention on Biodiversity and whatnot, just to call for a global vision of ending all deforestation and then doubling the native forest canopy in the next two decades. We need to double the existing canopy. In other words, we've got to stop deforestation, and then we've got to double our existing forests to sequester the carbon to scrub it out of the atmosphere so that we don't go to a 2 or 3 degree centigrade higher temperature world. That is a very scary situation. That would cause industrial agriculture to fail. That would cause not tens of millions, but a couple billion people to probably starve over the next several decades. And we can avoid that, and key to avoiding that is doubling the world's native forest canopy. I say native forest canopy because, you know, a eucalyptus monoculture plantation is not a forest. It doesn't provide the same function, and we need to restore the native forest because with that come the plants and animals and insects native to that area. The strengthening of biological diversity, the cleaning and filtering of air and water, and all of those ecosystem functions or services that nature provides. So part of the answer to your question is putting forth this bold vision about doubling the world's forests. And then there's two other components.
Well, how do you do that? Let's say that you had the money to go ahead and double the world's forests now. How do you replant a diverse forest ecosystem?
Well, there's a lot of work in conservation biology that's been done in the last 15 years and a lot of lessons learned. Forests, fortunately, oftentimes don't need our help. If we just get our foot off their throat, they will come back on their own. The real great tree planters in the world are not people like Harvey Wasserman and Randy Hayes on a weekend when we go out with our kids and friends and dig a hole and put a seedling in. The real tree planters are the birds. who eat the fruit and defecate the seeds as they're flying are all over the place. You know, nature itself will reforest in many cases. In some cases, we'll need to help that process along, but with conservation biology lessons learned, we can do that.
Amazing. We're talking with Randy Hayes. Randy, what's the name of your current organization?
It's Foundation Earth.
And your website?
Yeah, it's just foundationearth.org, but we have to abbreviate the word foundation, FDN, fdnearth.org.
Uh-huh. Okay. So are you, what is this you're going to unveil on Earth Day? Give us a preview.
It's that clarion call for action of halting all deforestation and doubling the canopy, the native forest canopy, in less than 20 years. But this is very specific to a strategy. Right now, you know, industrial civilization over the last 200 years has caused us to go from 280 parts per million of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, 280 parts per million, to over 400 parts per million. That's scary. That's dangerous. We've got to reverse that. Well, the only way to reverse it is, one, stop putting more up there, quit building coal-fired power plants and such, but also then by halting deforestation and doubling the forest, you are scrubbing carbon dioxide out of the air because trees absorb carbon dioxide and emit oxygen. You know, this is why they're often referred to as the lungs of the planet. And so as it turns out, we've got some people in England, Stephen Rumsey, doing the math on this. But if you doubled the world's forests, that would be enough to scrub enough carbon out of the atmosphere to begin to return us to pre-industrial civilization levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. In other words, going back from 400 to 200. That's a great ecological U-turn. That's a fundamentally different direction. Instead of the kind of toxic nightmare, right now we're turning the blue sky into a toxic furnace. That's what global warming is. Let's not call it global warming. Christ, it's much worse than that. We're turning the blue sky into a toxic furnace. We need to go a fundamentally different direction. We need a giant ecological U-turn, and we think forests will symbolize the great U-turn to a more socially just and ecologically sound society.
So where do you see the forests doubling? Are there specific areas that you have targeted geographically on this planet that you want to focus your energies on?
There's quite a lot of mapping, GIS, Geographic Information System mapping, that has been done in the last, particularly the last decade. And the satellite sophistication to get finer and finer resolution has helped enormously. But there are now maps of each continental area that show where the intact forest is, where the semi-degraded forest is, and where the heavily degraded forest is. Much of that heavily degraded area, in other words, is not forest anymore, is agricultural land. Some of it is what's called marginal agricultural land and could be returned to forests. And it could be include sort of agroforestry, where there's some crop growing. For instance, a lot of coffee growing can be done as an agroforestry instead of just vast fields out in the open area. You can do it in shade-grown coffee can be quite good for the process. So that kind of mapping has already been done. Bill Lawrence in Australia has a set of continental maps now that particularly show where we should not be building any more roads, because roads in pristine forest areas will allow for greater deforestation to happen. And so we have the common sense, of course, and rational thinking, at least in certain pockets. We don't have the political will, and we don't have common sense and rational thinking in the political process. That's what a lot of your listeners are probably saying to themselves right now. How the hell are we going to deal with that part of the problem? I think part of the answer to that has to do with the Mother Earth, our biosphere, the planet, is becoming spastic. That's what an extreme weather event is. It's really the biosphere becoming, the Earth becoming spastic, because the living, breathing life support systems of the biosphere are out of sync and out of kilter. So when you have heavy-duty floods in a typical dry region, or you have heavy-duty drought in a typically wet region, you know, or you have Category 5 hurricanes like Katrina and Sandy, you know, or you have unseasonable hurricanes and tornadoes and such, that is the Earth becoming spastic. These extreme weather events are starting to scare the hell out of tens of millions of people on every continent. And I don't know if that's going to be enough to create the political will, but we have to hope that some window of opportunities will open up so that we can drive these solutions through. And it will probably come out of sheer panic when nature attacks us a bit harder than she did with even Katrina and the current droughts of California.
Okay, so talking with Randy Hayes here, given the nature of our economic system, and you're talking now about ecologizing capitalism, with renewable energy, we have the advantage that people can make really big money on renewable energy. I mean, you and I know this, and I'm just waiting for the moment. We're now in a situation where, for example, the coal industry is being transcended by solar. Anybody with any brains and any money is going to be invested in renewables before they're going to invest in solar. I mean, in coal, and there are more people working in solar than there are in coal. So the handwriting is really on the wall, I think, for coal versus renewables. We're getting into the ballpark, certainly, with, well, gas. I think we're on a temporary swing here where gas is cheaper and people are making more money on gas maybe than they are on solar. But oil, at least for electricity, is long gone. And I see us emerging in the fairly near future with a solar power industry that has more money behind it than a lot of the what I call King Kong, coal, oil, nukes, and gas. Especially the coal part. Well, where is the money in preserving the forests? Who is going to come forward from the corporate world and make a profit on saving our forests?
Well, in the short term, the money for saving forests and designing some of these programs and funding some of these mapping systems like Global Forest Watch 2.0, some of your people sitting at computers can go Google Global Forest Watch. And the letters WRI, World Resource Institute. The Global Forest Watch has done a lot of this mapping of the world. It's an early warning system now. It was funded in large part by the Norwegian government. Oddly, they're using oil money from the Norwegian oil fields to fund some of the best ecological protection work on the planet. So some of the money is still blood money coming from the wrong direction. But the 20 biggest governments and economies of the world, what's called the G20, they are meeting in November in Turkey, and they are launching a plan to assemble $80 trillion with a T over the next 15 years for what they call infrastructure projects. Now, these are old paradigm thinking people. These are finance ministers who just want to go back to the good old Clinton days of linear economic growth. Those days are over. There's a new economic order unfolding right now, and they're never going to go back to that. They might create it for a few years, but what we need is this system shift to a new economic model. But the G8... The G20, through bilateral aid, in other words, aid from each of those countries, through the multilateral banks like the World Bank and the IMF and the Asian and African and Inter-American Development Banks, and the pension funds and the sovereign wealth funds can assemble trillions of dollars. Now, we just need to make that profitable, right? And that's going to take banning things like investing it in any new fossil fuel plants. There's no country right now that has an effective ban on fossil fuel plants that I'm aware of, maybe Bhutan and the Himalayas. But That's around the corner. People are going to start to see such things emerge over the next 3, 5, 7 years, in which case the profitability won't be there for things that are banned, right? And even if it's not banned, like natural gas will be the last to be banned of the fossil fuels, but bear in mind, it is no systemic solution. We do not want more natural gas plants. The methane emissions from natural gas plants are worse than coal in the first so many years, right? So that's not the systemic solution. That is not a bridge to a better world, right? We need to go to the wind and the solar. We need to go to the radical energy efficiency, you know, the super windows in every building on planet Earth, the insulation, less energy use. We need the walkable cities, the mass transit systems. That's the kind of infrastructure we want to see this $80 trillion go into, those kinds of things. And they are profitable. They'll be
How are they profitable? How are they? Tell me how the green infrastructure is profitable to an investor beyond renewables. We know about renewables. Renewable energy has a product. It has a price. It fluctuates, of course, and people pay money for it. What prompts people to pay money for a sustainable forest?
Well, carbon offsets is a controversial program. It's got a lot of downsides to it, but I can walk you through the mechanics, and you can see how it makes it profitable to protect a standing forest, right? Because a forest is standing, if it's likely in the next so many years to be deforested, turned into cattle pasture in Brazil and the Amazon, and you have got carbon-emitting power plants in Europe or wherever that are above their allowable budget, then they have to pay to sequester that carbon. So avoided deforestation is one of the UN mechanisms for doing that. That means if you, Harvey Wasserman, owned 100 square miles of Amazon rainforest, somebody would pay you every year as long as you could ground truth and guarantee that those trees were still standing.
Right, likewise, but that's a government program. That's not market-driven.
Well, right now it is voluntary market-driven. There's a voluntary market doing that. But yes, that's a government program. But it's still money changing hands, and it's not 100% government program because it's not tax dollars funding it. In other words, an aging power plant that's got 5 more years to go will have to pay money each year for the next 5 years till it's shut down to offset its emissions. That's where the money comes from. So it comes from the market back into the market to the person who owns 100 acres of forest that says, I won't let anybody cut it down if you pay me every year. Or if you had 100 acres of land that was once forest and you want to reforest it, that qualifies also. So there is money to be made in this process.
Right, but it's not it's not stuff that's bought and sold. This is a value that's assigned by a governmental agency to an ecological benefit.
Correct.
So, okay, now there's a role for that. The carbon tax, I suppose, would fit into that. Is that correct?
Yeah, the carbon tax would absolutely fit into it because that creates a bucket of money. And if some of that money is spent for reforestation, then that's what funds, you know, a bunch of aging hippies to go out there and plant trees, or a bunch of young millennials to go out there and have meaningful livelihood solving the world's problems by doubling the forest canopy around the planet.
Well, I'm reminded, of course, that Franklin Roosevelt, in the midst of the Dust Bowl, had the Civilian Conservation Corps plant 32 million trees. And he was once asked what is your profession, and he said, "I'm a tree farmer," and it certainly had a major impact. It did definitely. They planted a line of trees across the western edge of the Great Plains, and it definitely cut down on the Dust Bowl. But that was, of course, a government program. What we're looking for is product that could come out of a sustainable forest that would find its way into the marketplace.
Well, that'll be part of the mix, but we can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We need responsible public governance. And we have to recognize that in a lot of cases there is market failure, right? When people annihilate an entire forest, clear cut it into oblivion for short-term profits, that's market failure because the long-term benefits of that forest are in some cases gone forever. And so we need a mixture of the market. But let me get back to the phrase ecologizing capitalism.
Okay.
When I stepped down from running Rainforest Action Network and being the director of sustainability for San Francisco and Oakland, you know, I went back to the ecological textbooks of Herman Daly and some of the great thinkers, and I reread them and read my notes in the margins, and I came up with two major ways in which the global economy really fails from an ecological perspective. The first is that there's no mechanism to ratchet economic activity down around carrying capacity limits. The second is in the market right now, people are allowed to pollute mostly for free, and there's no systematic way to eradicate that free ride. So a better name for the current economic system is cheater economics. The more a company cheats by dumping its toxins into the river and setting up sweatshops and forced labor camps, then the more profitable they are. So that's cheater economics, right?
There's also a term called the tragedy of the commons, where people, I forget who coined it, it was a famous environmentalist, and people are allowed
Garrett Hardin?
Yes, they're allowed to gouge out private profit out of the public domain and not pay a price for it.
Well, yes, that's exactly. That's really kind of my second point about what are called, in economics, it's called externalities. So the pollution costs are external to the market price.
Right. In Iraq, they were called ancillary casualties. So it's pretty much the same mindset.
It is. It's absolutely the same phenomenon. And a carbon tax is basically to penalize a polluter. It's a polluter pay principle. And so that, you know, a lot of your listeners will quite understand that phrase, the polluter pays, right? And to the extent they pay, their goods and services become more expensive, and so the cleaner ones are cheaper, and everybody likes a bargain. So if you internalize those pollution externalities into the price of things, then the cleanest processes, ecologically cleanest processes, become the cheapest. And when the cleanest is the cheapest, we can save the planet because that works with human nature in the sense of, I mean, Bill Gates likes a bargain, Harvey Wasserman likes a bargain, Randy Hayes likes a bargain, a lot of your listeners like a bargain. And so when we have true cost pricing, so if cheater economics is the name of the system right now that we don't like, a true cost economy is the economic model that we want to seek. Whatever kind of economy it is, it needs to tell the truth, the ecological truth about the cost to the earth and the cost to the future, as David Brower, the great environmentalist, used to say. We need to tell the truth about those costs, factored into the price of things, and then we can use the market to solve the problem in much of the case.
But that requires legislation.
That does take a level of government regulation, insight, and common sense. And that is lacking in the political process, particularly here in Washington, D.C. As I look out the window at the magnolia trees and dogwood trees that are just starting to blossom here, it's so pretty and nice. But the politics is a failed state in this city.
Yeah, absolutely. So the question then is, how do you... And especially in a situation now in this country where we have corporate personhood, I mean, I would have to say that the greatest threat to the human race at this point in time is corporate personhood, because you've empowered with unlimited rights or unlimited privileges, really, an economic and industrial entity that absolutely has only one imperative, and that is to make profit, and has absolutely no feedback mechanism for a human or ecological need.
It's a very dangerous situation. What we have to do is put the public back into public governance, because we don't have, I prefer the phrase public governance to democracy. We have a kind of corporate controlled democracy right now. And I can remember John O'Connor years ago saying, we're told we have a two-party system in the United States, but from his analysis, he saw the Democratic side of the big business party and the Republican side of the big business party. Now, there was not, this is not a distinction without any difference. I think that the Republican Party is much more bought off by big business, but the Democratic Party is no bastion of the ecological paradigm shift to a better world either, right? And
right.
So we have to put the public back in charge of things, but it's got to be an informed public, particularly informed about how the world works ecologically. We need to understand the life support systems of the biosphere. We need to show reverence for that system. We need to kind of honor the ways of nature and make sure that our business practices are in sync with the ways of nature and our lifestyles are in sync with the ways of nature. We need massive programs to get over consumers down to sustainable levels of consumption. And we also need programs to get under consumers up to a dignified level of sustainable production and consumption. If you're malnourished and starving, you're an under-consumer. There are under-consumers out there in the world, so let's help them out. But let's not be knee-jerk liberals and only think that's the problem. The greater problem is the need for overconsumption reduction, right? And we don't see anybody really attending to that except maybe Foundation Earth a little bit. We talk about it on our website. There's the World Bank thinks its mission is poverty alleviation, and yet they fund economic development in the same old-school coal-fired power plant ways of the last century. We need the World Bank of overconsumption reduction to help get Japan and Europe and the United States down to sustainable levels of consumption. That's going to take lifestyle shifts, but it can, as people will tell us, it could be a far better lifestyle and what a lot of people in this industrial mad world are now living with.
Talking with Randy Hayes of Foundation Earth, a long time, a very long time activist with a really deep understanding of many of the problems we face. Randy and I are old buddies, going way, way back to the Rainforest Action days. Randy was the founder, actually, of Rainforest Action Network, and has worked with some of the great minds of the ecological movement over the decades. Randy, you've put out a paper here. I'm looking at it online here. Foundation Earth, Rethinking Society from the Ground Up, Investments and the Nine Planetary Boundaries. Tell us a bit about this.
Well, what evolved over billions of years in our solar system on this planet, right, are a set of systems that support life, right? So we don't have so much individual things that are disconnected. The field of ecology is about the interconnection of systems. An ecosystem is an ecological system. It's the set of interactions between the fertility of the soil and the breathable air and the plants and animals all mixing in there together, right, to allow life to exist. At the planetary level, at the biosphere level, you know, we have hydrologic cycles, we have nitrogen cycles, we have phosphorus cycles, we have climatic cycles, you know, we have the oceans and the ocean currents. Scientists in the year 2009 from Stockholm, something called the Stockholm Resilience Center, a guy named, I'm blanking on his name right now, one of those difficult Swedish names, but he created the Planetary Boundaries Framework. And if you think of it as ecological boundaries, the Germans call it the planetary guardrails. You don't want to bump up and go over these guardrails or you're going to be in trouble. You're going to be in danger zone. So the nine planetary ecological boundaries are things like the freshwater cycle, the ocean acidification problem, the climate systems, and they can calculate for each of these nine subsystems a safe operating zone. And so if you use too much fresh water and you drain your underground aquifers, right, and you create less rainfall because of deforesting big areas. The Amazon, you know, generates about half of its own rainfall from evapotranspiration from the leaves back up into the atmosphere. So these systems are well understood in the field of earth sciences right now. It's very exciting. And, you know, on our website, we have this two-page summary that makes it easy for people to understand the planetary boundaries. It's very well known, actually, in Europe and other parts of the world. It's just catching on in North America as a scientific framework to help us solve our problems.
So tell us specifically more. You've got stratospheric ozone depletion, et cetera. Run through these nine boundaries so you can familiarize our solartopian community here with exactly what you're talking about.
Well, I've mentioned most of them, and I don't have the list to read off of, but so
by
dismal memory, let me just say that most people recall the ozone crisis when chlorofluorocarbons from spray cans were seeping up into the higher atmosphere and destroying the protective cover of the ozone, right?
Right.
And so we need that protective cover. It helps avoid radiation from the sun and protect us. So that's one of them. Fresh water cycle is pretty easy for people to understand.
Well, here, Randy, let me run through these real quick, and I'd like you to just comment on each one. So stratospheric ozone depletion, we know about that. Chlorofluorocarbons were reduced. Apparently did have some positive impact on that, right?
Yeah, the Montreal Protocol was the international treaty, a government treaty, that solved that problem.
Okay, you think it's solved? You think
largely, not entirely. The alternative products are not pure as the driven snow. They're a lesser of evils, but the ozone is somewhat rebuilding, and so it's not the worst problem at all.
So let me throw you this softball question here. Did the human political organizing to reduce ozone depleting chemicals in our various economic products have an impact?
Did the organizers working on that have
an impact? The human response to the ozone depletion problem, did it have an impact?
I think the two examples of humanity solving global environmental problems are we've largely saved the whales. You know, the Japanese are still cheating the system somewhat, and the Norwegians as well. But that aside, you know, Greenpeace led a fight around the world to save the whales, and we've largely solved that problem, okay? And the second one is the ozone crisis. That was a simpler one to solve than climate change because there were only a handful of giant companies who made those evil chemicals. And so we could get them in the room, we could offer them an alternative product that was much less bad, and things got better.
All right, so we're starting, this is like a Buddhist exercise here. We're going through the Four Noble Truths and the Eight-Step Path. So all our Solartopians out there can take heart that we have had this impact. And I will chime in that in 1974, Richard Nixon said there'd be 1,000 commercial atomic reactors in the United States by 2000, and here we are in 2015, and there are 99. And they never got above, I think 116 was the most they had. They built around 130 or so, and so we are definitely headed in the right direction with nuclear power as well. The second item you have here is biosphere integrity. Tell us about that.
Well, the biosphere integrity, I think that's a renaming of what was called biological diversity loss. In other words, that we need biological diversity on the planet for us humans to survive. You know, there are a number of ways to explain why that is so, right? So it's not just an inalienable right for all the different creatures in the web of life to exist. I believe in that inalienable right and want them to have a future. But that aside, you know, even our human bodies are systems within systems. We're embedded systems. Our digestive system is full of all kinds of creatures in there that help us digest our food, right? That's biological diversity. If we didn't have that diversity, we would not survive in that simple sense. But also, if you don't have forests kind of scrubbing and cleaning the air, creating oxygen and cleaning the air, and providing a steady supply of fresh, clean water, because they also do that as well, that the biological diversity of the plants and animals and trees and forests, that helps us survive. That's why that kind of integrity of the planet and biological diversity is on the list of 9.
Okay, very good. And I want to point out, by the way, there's a contrast. Most native civilizations were very good at biological diversity, and Western civilization really, as it came into the Americas and elsewhere, emphasized monoculture. And we really want to get away from monoculture entirely and towards what you'll call here biosphere integrity. Number 3, chemical dispersion and the release of novel entities.
Yeah, we have poison-soaked agricultural fields of monoculture crops all over the friggin' planet. And that kind of toxicity is seeping into not just our body tissues as humans. You know, it seeps into all of the animals and insects and animals and plants in different ways, right? People have heard about the pollinator crisis with the collapse of bee colonies, right? And we've lost over half of the bee colonies here in the United States in the last so many years. That's scary stuff. Something like 1 in every 3 bites of food that we eat requires pollinators to pollinate those crops, or we don't have that food to eat. And so if we toxify the world and the bees continue and other pollinators die off, then goodbye life support system and goodbye the human species.
It appears to me, isn't it true that in Europe they have banned nicotinoids I've totally butchered that word, I'm sure, but that are causing most of the bees to die, and we have not done it here?
Yeah, the neonicotinoids is the category of pesticides. And yes, Europe has banned them. There's greater and greater scientific evidence that this is causing the collapse, the death of bees, but also the weakening and the ill health of bees. And so Center for Food Safety in Washington, D.C. is leading a number of lawsuits to try to stop that here in the United States. It's gaining a lot of momentum. For any listeners on the island of Hawaii, they've been fighting this problem and creating neonicotinoid-free zones for agriculture and genetically modified organism-free zones for agriculture. Some of the native people and other islanders in Hawaii are leading that charge, and we congratulate them.
Absolutely. Number 4 is climate change. Now, I really don't like the term climate change, and I don't like the term global warming. It's climate chaos or global weirding, as far as I'm concerned. But you have climate change here, so tell us about that really quickly.
Yeah, well,
Hunter Lovins uses
global weirding quite a lot. And global weirding really plays into the phrase that I mentioned earlier, ecospasms. That's the global weirding, is the planet's getting spastic and weird. Right, so you're right. No, global warming and climate change, that's why I was saying earlier, it's not global warming. We're turning the blue sky into a toxic furnace, Let's tell the truth about this. That's not okay. We've got to go a fundamentally different direction, and hence why we're calling for this U-turn. So people will say that it's the most important issue on Earth right now. Well, it's one of a set of the most important issues. Each of the 9 boundaries is an important issue. And if you lose any one of them, you could lose the whole thing, right? So some of this fixation on climate change is not well placed. Does that mean it's not an issue to work on? Absolutely, it's an issue to work on, right? But biodiversity loss is just as important, if not more important, to work on, because it's in more dangerous, troubled waters right now. We're talking about the 6th great extinction, The last one being the dinosaurs, you know, that died off. That was a massive overnight extinction. This one won't be so overnight, but it may be actually more massive if we go to a 4 degrees centigrade hotter world. All of industrial agriculture fails. Virtually all of humanity dies off, and we lose 90% of the species. This is serious stuff. The house is on fire. This is why we set up Foundation Earth, to say we need a big rethink from the ground up.
Okay, number five is ocean acidification.
Right. So a lot of people won't know, they'll know that they have to be careful about how much fish they eat because of the mercury in the fish. They won't necessarily know that the primary source of that mercury comes from the burning of coal-fired power plants. Coal-fired power plants, mercury is a metal, right? And mercury occurs naturally in coal formations. And when you burn the coal, metals don't burn the way carbon, wood fiber and such burns, right? It just kind of vaporizes, but that doesn't mean disappear. And then it falls into the ocean, and it bioaccumulates from the small fish to the medium fish to the big fish. And now you can't eat too many swordfish every week, or you're going to give yourself too much mercury. Well, not only is the mercury falling on the ocean, but that carbon dioxide is getting sucked up in the ocean. And that's taking it and turning it into a more acid-like substance. And when you have a more acid-like substance in the ocean water, the salt water of the oceans, then a number of the sea creatures, plants and animals, you know, so whether it's algae or seaweed or fish, will die off, and we'll end up with nothing but, you know, jellyfish out there. And that's not a very exciting diet.
Yeah, jellyfish, boy, get me going on that. Freshwater
use. The major way to solve the ocean acidification problem is to quit burning fossil fuels, to get to solartopia, to get to wind and solar and low-energy lifestyles.
Okay, we got four more here, and we got about five more minutes. Let's do it real quick. Randy, okay, you are one brilliant guy, I got to tell you. I mean, you and I have been friends a long time. You are a hell of a good guy to go out drinking with, but you really have a great brain here, and I never cease to be impressed.
And I have to go to an Amazon Watch drinking reception right after this interview.
Oh, poor you. I really pity you. Okay, here. Freshwater use, land system change, biochemical flows, and atmospheric aerosol loading. Can you do them all in 5 minutes?
Yeah, the fresh water, people don't need much more on that. We understand it. You know, you can go a few days without food, but it's hard to go a few days without water, right? So good enough on that one.
Yes, and of course, California, as we started out talking, has a serious problem. And we do want to mention, of course, that fracking is a huge destroyer of fresh water. It's a major
Absolutely.
Crisis in itself, isn't it?
Absolutely. They add toxic chemicals to it and then pump it under the earth where we can't even get at it and use it, and we wouldn't want to drink it if we could get at it. So that's just a triple tragedy there. We need to stop all fracking, I believe. It's also causing earthquakes, and that's dangerous. What was the other one? Atmospheric
loading? Land system change.
So land system change is where, you know, if you've got a saltwater marsh, but, you know, or a swampy area that if you landfill it, you may lose its ability to buffer an incoming hurricane from the ocean. So that kind of land system change, it's massive all around the planet, but particularly in coastal zones, like the example of landfill. A lot of people know how big the San Francisco Bay is. It used to be one-third bigger. It's been landfilled massively, and that's not okay, right? So we have to stop a lot of this land change, and at least with Katrina and Louisiana, they're restoring some of the native aspects of the beach and the sand dunes and the proper land use.
Right, and as we know, with Katrina, it wasn't just the failure of the levees. It had a lot to do with the removal of the buffer areas with housing and other development, and the draining of swamps and all the other wreckage
right.
that was done, the havoc that was wreaked on the land system around New Orleans, it really magnified the impact of Katrina. Biochemical flows, including nitrogen and phosphorus cycling.
Now that one's very, very important. Artificial fertilizers, two of the major fertilizers in industrial agriculture are nitrogen and phosphorus. Both are absolutely fundamental for plant growth. So nature has a natural nitrogen cycle and a natural phosphorus cycle. You need some of it, but if you have too much, you're in trouble. You'll turn it into a toxin. People have heard of the dead zones at the end of the Mississippi River out in the Gulf, where the primarily the fertilizers from agriculture in the vast watershed of the Mississippi flow down through just one river, the Mississippi, and all of that pollution and toxicity goes into the Gulf. It destroys the oxygen in the water that fish need to breathe and creates a dead zone. There are over 400 of those dead zones off of rivers around the world, and that's caused by industrial agriculture. And so we have to go to the world of organic agriculture, go back to family farmers, and that kind of wholesome approach is a major part of the solution in the systemic change.
Right, and of course, that's true in the Everglades as well. In Florida, I was on a foundation for many years that dealt with that problem, and of course, phosphorus is the ultimate culprit. And finally, atmospheric aerosol loading.
Think of that as air pollution. Think of that as dirty air. Think of that as what you hear about China right now and what we used to hear about Japan, where they had oxygen tanks on certain street corners in downtown Tokyo in the old days. They've cleaned it up a little bit right now, and also their economic depression means they pollute less. But now, under this economic bubble of China, they have hideous air pollution. And so that's simply air pollution. And it not only affects the lungs of children with asthma and sends them to the hospital, but it affects the lungs of all animals and, in fact, the respiratory systems of plants and insects as well.
Including human beings, of course.
Yes, we must include us humans.
So, Randy Hayes, we got like a minute left. Give us a one-minute summary of what needs to be done. It's so great. You know, we failed. You and I discussed over drinks that we were going to talk about Ted Cruz as a space alien. We really didn't get to that. But tell us.
I know. But people should notice that every time they see a house with a red door, there's a good chance that house is occupied by space aliens. You know, I like this image of the lizard people, and somehow there's a lizard-like quality to Ted Cruz.
Yeah.
And so people just beware, you know, be very
just
careful.
Just beware.
Well,
Randy Hayes, you are a great guest. We have to have you
I will,
back on.
I will just sort of conclude by saying we're really the last generation to have a chance to make enough change so that the next generation has a chance to be the last generation to have a chance. And that's how it's going to unfold. We have done 200 years of industrial civilization damage to this planet. We've done actually 7,000 years of agricultural land use damage to this planet. The great U-turn needs to start right now, and Foundation Earth is going to help put out that vision, starting with the fulcrum point of doubling the world's forests.
Thank you, Randy Hayes. You're going to come back with us, Foundation Earth, fdnearth.org, and we'll see you next week in Solartopia.
All right, bye-bye, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you, Randy.
Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.